And we are in a series called Secret Lives. And so this is week two of Secret Lives. And the idea is just that, that we would live lives that are open and honest. Because what's kind of wild is in many ways, it's there's been this move that a lot of people see the church as a place of hiddenness, that the church isn't honest. And so we don't want to be that kind of community. We want to be a community that's rooted in Christ and that we're open and honest with our lives. So we are kind of sharing out of that. And before I invite Brighton to come up, he's going to come and share some of his story. Just a little word to kind of preface in the mode of this series. There is a story in the book of Exodus. So in the Bible, you pick it up, to your far left is Genesis, and that's the first book, and then there's Exodus, but Exodus being the second book is really in many ways the central book for the Hebrew people, because it's here that they are rescued from slavery and become a nation, and they grow into this. So in the book of Exodus, the way it begins is we meet a man, first as a baby, named Moses. And so Moses is a Hebrew baby, but then he is raised by Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. His daughter raises him. And then you'll get to chapter 2 of Exodus, and it says then that Moses, now that he is all grown up and he is raised in Pharaoh's home, so he is someone of influence and in power. And he goes out of his home one day, he's out of the palace, and he's walking about, and there are the Hebrew people that are enslaved by the Egyptians. And he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And the way the story goes is Moses, he walks up and he sees this, and then it says he looks this way, and he looks that way, and when he sees that no one is looking, he kills the Egyptian and buries him in the sand. And then the next day, Moses walks out again, and now he sees a Hebrew beating another Hebrew, and they're fighting. And he goes up to him, and he says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And one of the people speaks from one of the Hebrew people and says, "Who put you in charge? Who made you ruler and leader over us? Are you going to do to us what you did to the Egyptian?" And all of a sudden, Moses has this sense of panic, and the text says, "What I have done must have been found out." And so what he does is he runs. He takes off and he runs into the Midian desert. And then for the next 40 years, he hides as a shepherd for 40 years in the desert. He runs. Why? Because he's got secrets buried in the sand. He buried someone in the sand and he thought that would be covered up. And he's like, my response here isn't to own it, name it, and just say, yeah, I blew it, I went off course, whoa. Instead, he runs. And he lives in the desert for 40 years as a shepherd. And then in that 40 years, he is out. And then a story that a lot of you know, he's out tending his flock. And then he sees a bush in the middle of the desert on fire, and he notices it, and he pays attention. This thing is not being consumed. And then he stops to look at it, and then God speaks to him. And says, "Moses, you're paying attention. I've got something for you to do." 40 years into the desert, though, he says this. And he says, "Here's what I need you to do, Moses. Take off your shoes, your sandals, because the ground you're standing on is holy." Now, here's the thing. It's not now just holy. It's always been holy. You haven't engaged. You haven't been paying attention. But it's holy. Wake up to this, take off your shoes, recognize it, and I have something for you to do. And then Moses goes on to lead the people, the Hebrew people, out of slavery. But what gets me is 40 years, he wanders in the desert as a shepherd because he ran, because he had secrets buried in the sand, and rather than own it, name it, instead he tried to hide from it. 40 years. Could you imagine 40 years that you wander, that you hide, that you try and bury something and say, "No one will figure this out, or I'll just run from those who do know this." Wouldn't want that for us. We want to be a community that doesn't have secrets hiding into the sand. So what do we want to be? We want to be a community, a Walker Harbor, that we are archaeologists and that we would excavate our souls and uncover any secrets that are buried in the sand and be an honest community. And so as a part of that, with this series, what we've invited is people to come and share their story a bit, kind of some of the pieces and parts and what God has been up to in their life and kind of how their life journey has been. Why? Because we want to be a community that knows one another and is known. And so I'd like to take a moment and just pray before Brighton comes up and shares, and there's going to be a song that he plays beforehand that he would love, that kind of means a lot to him. So we'll play a song, and then we'll give our attention to Brighton. So, Father God, we're grateful for this morning, grateful for the opportunity to gather, to hear from you. And God, you know us. There is no hiding from you. And so that we would not hide from one another either. That we would be a community that is honest, that lives with transparency, and that looks to follow you. And so, God, now as we pause here for a moment, just, God, I pray that you speak your love, your grace, your mercy, your compassion through Brighton. God, that you in his story would shine through. And we're grateful for him, for his life, God, and what you've been up to in it. We bless you for Brighton. And we pray all of this in the name of Christ Jesus. Amen.
Most of you probably have never heard that song before. We'll get more to that song here in a little bit. I have to start by apologizing to my mom and my sister. Again, we'll get more to that song, but it means a lot to us. And my mom literally walked in here this morning and she said to me, "Oh, you know that song? I heard it on the way here, and I was just, I can't not bawl when I hear that song." So sorry for setting you guys up. My name is Brighton Mansfield. I live around the area. I lived here now for about 3 years, and I'm a dentist around here. Please don't all run away at once. I know you. It's not that you don't dislike me, you just dislike what I do. I've heard that so many times. I moved to the area about 3 years ago. I married a wonderful woman and into a wonderful family, and my mother-in-law had an unwritten contract that when the time was right, I had to move back here. And so I am here, and I love it. I love being here. I grew up on the east side of the state in a city called Adrian, Michigan. It's about 45 minutes south of Ann Arbor, and it's just a tiny, not a tiny community, but a mid-size, but a very family-oriented small group of good people. So I will tell you, I'm not typically very open about my life story, and so when Wally asked me to talk, honestly, the first thing that came to my mind is about a year ago, I was at a summer basketball camp, and I happened to be a part of the camp DVD that all the campers get at the end of the camp, and my kids happened to see it. And I'm in a small part where I'm literally just moving through the shot, like I don't speak or anything like that. But because of that, my kids think I'm legendary, like they think I'm a movie star. And so when Wally asked me to do this, I turned to my wife, and we were talking about it, and I just said, "Will it be podcasted?" And she said, "Yeah, I think so." And I said, "Sweet," because my oldest is starting to think I'm not as cool as Mickey, and this could like really bring up the street cred if I'm on the internet. And so that was kind of where I thought to myself, more than anything else, yes, this would be great. But I have a relatively unique life, and for most of it, up until about 3 years ago, most everyone around me has known my life story, or at least been aware of the bulk of it. And I will tell you that when I was younger, I felt that my life was something that many thought needed to be seen as kind of an example of how you go through poor circumstances and don't fail miserably, I suppose. And with good intentions, many people wanted me to be that representation and share my story with people. I went to a school that is a Christian school, and I remember one time a Bible teacher pointing me out in high school and just saying, you know, you remind me of this particular missionary. And I kind of looked at him like, well, I don't know what that means. And then he gave me a book. I read it, and then I was like, oh, I still don't know what that means. But then I had classmates come up to me and go, why do you think he said that? And like wanted to read about this missionary. And I thought to myself, well, I have no clue. Let's not look into it. I just didn't like the idea of being the ideal image for someone to follow. I like beer, more so whiskey. I like really loud music. I enjoy to party, and I have sworn at least once in my life. And so in full disclosure, I've even skipped church doing one of those things before. And so I just didn't want to be the image that someone looked up to. But I'm here today. So here we go. So bear with me. A couple things. First of all, I can be really sarcastic. I try to make jokes when the mood gets really sad. And I probably will cry during this and just be mindful that if I do cry, it usually is out of a joyful kind of feeling. I do get sad, and I think that's very normal. But if I cry, you're more than welcome to, I suppose. So we'll start with my name. I have a really unusual name, cat's out of the bag, Brighton, and that's where the story starts. So I am the baby of four. I am completely unplanned, and I am what you would call an oops baby. My mom, Susie, she is a counselor. My father was a contractor, construction guy, businessman, and they fell in love as high school sweethearts and never looked back. My parents had my oldest sister, Brooke, when they were in their early 20s. And following Brooke, my parents had some challenges getting pregnant again. And my mom was diagnosed with a cyst on one of her ovaries. After finding that out, she shortly thereafter had the ovary removed surgically. And then about 6.5 years later, after my oldest sister, Brooke, they had my older brother, Bronson. And then about 3.5 years later, they had my other older sister, Bree. And from there, the two of them confirmed that five was exactly what they wanted, and they were very satisfied. They had all the joy that they would need, and they lived out the rest of their days as a family of five. And then, surprise, hi, I'm Brighton. So essentially it goes that if you have an ovary removed, you only need one tube tied. And so that's literally what they did. When my mom got her tubes tied, they tied one tube. And they found out that surprises happen. And so the story goes that they were explaining to my mom and dad what was going on. And my dad walked to the nearest wall, braced himself, and learned about surprises. But my dad actually named me, and he said that my name would be Brighton because I was here to brighten everyone's day. My mom claims that she saw that I was going to be a dentist and that I was here to brighten everyone's smile. Everybody knows one. They whine a lot, they get everything that they need, and they need to be surrounded by people, the baby of the family. And that is me. I am a true baby of the family, and I have a great family. And I mean great. Obviously, I grew up with three phenomenal siblings, and they were all awesome. They are all awesome people. They cared about each other. They cared about people around them, and they were they're God-fearing people that sought Christ before anything else. And we learn that from our parents. I specifically remember as a child when I would get out of bed, I would rush into my parents' room. I'm learning that's apparently what you do as a child. You just go to your parents' room when you wake up in the morning. And they would be getting ready, and both of them would be reading their Bibles and doing their devotions. And I witnessed that every single day, and it was very consistent. It happened every single day. And they chose that they wanted to live their lives and focus on Christ. And it shaped my perspective. It shaped my priorities at a very young age. That is what I saw. I was also blessed to have aunts, uncles, cousins, family friends that did the same thing. And I remember specifically November 10th, 1996, I sat with my mom at our family home at our kitchen table, and my mom gave me a now and later to display to me that Christ was going to be present in my life now and later, and I accepted Christ as my Savior. I was 10 years old and almost 11, and I contribute Christ's hand in my life and my parents' example for essentially creating that part of me that lived day in and day out to want to grow closer to Christ. And it started at that age. I can honestly say that. I remember feeling like this is a big deal, and I sought after that. And it stuck with me, and it has been the one thing in my life that has been essentially the lamp on my feet, that has given me a light on the path. So July 23rd, 2000, I describe that as forever a bad day. It's weird, but I will literally never be able to see the number 23 the same. My dad was a huge basketball fan, and he gave that gift to me, taught me basketball, taught me to love the game. And my favorite player is Michael Jordan. I to this day cannot see number 23, which is like on everything now, and see Michael Jordan. I see July 23rd, 2000. My dad was the greatest father a boy could have. He was gentle but stern. He was funny but serious, and he had like the biggest hands you've ever seen. Literally, the wedding ring that I'm wearing is made from his wedding ring, and I have big hands, and they literally the we had to have it reshaped, and the jewelry store told me, "You've got a ton of ring left over. The ring was too big." And we were able to make like a necklace thing out of it because his hands were so big. But he was this just big, powerful man that also could wrap his arms around you and just love you. And that's the best way to describe him. He was a loving man. And it was a beautiful Sunday afternoon. I happened to be the only kid home that morning, and I went with my mom and my dad to church, and I remember dressing like my dad. I put on a yellow shirt because I wanted to look like him. And I sat in church, and I remember him taking notes during the sermon, and I took notes right next to him. And that afternoon, my whole family was together. My oldest sister was away in Florida, but the rest of my family was present. We were going to celebrate my grandpa's 80th birthday party, and there was a large number of family and friends surrounding us, and while my grandpas, both of them, sat talking to my dad, who was grilling, he collapsed and died of a massive heart attack, and he was 49 years old. I was 14. I watched my aunts perform CPR. I saw the face of horror in my mom's face. I saw my siblings panic like crazy. And I'll never forget my brother and I throwing chairs out of the way for an ambulance. And I can forever describe that day as just a bad day. There's no other way to describe it. But I had a really interesting experience through the whole time that was happening. This voice just kept telling me, don't blame God. Don't blame God. And so I prayed, like any wise 14-year-old. I prayed, God, don't let me blame you. And I prayed it on repeat as they took my dad away. It was the best conversation I ever had with God. It still surprises me when I tell the story that I did that. I don't think it was me. But I still sit and I go, huh, I did not see that coming. It was a surprise. The next few months, to be honest with you, were quite a blur. A lot of sadness, a lot of crying, a lot of depression, a lot of sleeping. That's what I do when I'm sad and depressed. And a lot of anger at people around me. But I also, outside of that blur, there's this like just huge memory of the family and friends that surrounded us and took care of us. I remember a group of my dad's best friends come and essentially abruptly just kind of come into my brother and I's day. And they called us outside of our house. It was like, well, what are they doing to us? You know, are they going to beat us or something? They were like, get out here. And the five of them stood around us and they just said, we're just telling you this right now. We are going to be your dads from now on. And the really cool part is 18 years later, they still are. They still check in on me. I could call them at any moment. It was amazing. I remember my mom's friends organized meals for us. Like literally, they created a calendar with meals. Like every single night, we were going to have a meal. And I got to the point where I started to pick out my favorite ones. Mrs. Schaefer, she had the greatest food. Like I was like, yes, she's Wednesday. And each one of these people, they did those things with Christ in mind. They didn't tell me that. I watched it. Great friends and family, and they made a huge impact on my life. Huge impact. After those events, my oldest sister, Brooke, was married about a year prior, a little over a year prior to my dad's death, and she lived in Florida after she was, well, just before she was married, she moved down there and she lived in Orlando, Florida. And so through all this, my oldest brother was kind of seen as the, all right, you're going to be the assistant. He stepped in. He wanted to do it, but he was going to be my mom's assistant, basically. So he had finished his freshman year at Calvin College in the spring right before my father passed away. And so he decided he wanted to move home and essentially help to close out many of my father's construction projects and essentially become the man of the house. And so in addition to that, my dad had a small self-serve car wash that he had just kind of had as a side business sort of situation. And he and my mom, my brother and my mom, decided that what they would do is after closing out my dad's contracts, they would then revamp this car wash and make it kind of the family business and let my brother run it. Now, most of you are like, wait, he was 19 years old. Like, well, that's a little risky, but the reality was I looked at my older brother like he could have handled it. And you can ask anybody, he could. This was a big project, but for him, it just wasn't. He literally was just good at everything he touched. He stepped in as a 19-year-old and was like a father figure to me. I don't know many 19-year-olds that could pull that off and do it with all seriousness, and you look at him and go, yeah, well, that makes sense. He could do it. But he was the guy that could do it. He was larger than life to me. And over the next 16, 17 months, really, he did that. He undertook that project. And he was just a gifted guy, and he was my big brother. But December 27th, 2001 is also forever a bad day. It was a relatively mild Thursday morning. I was on Christmas break, and that morning I was planning to get ready to go to a basketball practice. And before I made it out the door, I was there's a knock at the door, and the local county sheriff was there, and he wondered if my mother was home and if I knew how to reach her. He had advised me that my brother was in some trouble and that I needed to reach her, but he didn't seem too urgent. And so I called my mom, who was actually at the hospital at that time because my sister Bree had an athletic injury where she was having a surgery done to take care of it. And I didn't get a hold of her, and so I just left her a voicemail. I'm sure it was like, hey, mom, sounds like Bronson's in trouble. All right, have a great day. Bye. Like any 16-year-old, I literally left it at that, and I drove to practice. I got to practice, and I was warming up in our high school gym, and one of actually the five men that came and said, hey, we're going to be your dads from now on, he came into the gym on the opposite side of the gym, and came through the doors, and it wouldn't be unusual to see him there. He had helped coach before, so on and so forth. And so when he came in, I wasn't too surprised, but the look on his face was one of like, I did something wrong. And he literally walked the entire court without saying a word, and his face was just solid as a rock. And I thought, run. I was like, run. And before I could, he got to me and he grabbed me by the jersey, like forcefully grabbed me by the jersey. He walked me out of the gym and he took me into the hallway of my high school, and he said, and he held it together for most of the part, but then he just started to sob and he said to me, Bronson's gone. And he told me that my brother had essentially hit black ice in his truck, and he had hit a tree and died. My brother was 21 and I was 16 years old. It was 17 months after my dad died, almost to the day. And I had like the same overwhelming sense, like, don't blame God. But I can tell you, there was this big question mark this time, like, what in the world? Like, don't blame God, but what? But we still had that same awesome group of family and friends. The safety net was there. I went through kind of the same. It was like, literally, it was like a rerun. Actually, more like a sequel. You just kind of like, same characters are just moving on to the next stage. But those same family friends were there, and they provided hugs, love. They did the food schedule again, which was huge. And I will be honest with you, in my opinion, it probably would have been less likely for me to fail because of their support than not. And that's just the reality. They were amazing. But at some point in time, you leave home. And when you leave home, you leave your safety net behind. You know that it's still there, and you know what it would encourage you to do and not do, but it's far enough away that you start to essentially test the waters. I was just talking with my mom a couple weeks ago, and she, she's amazing. She told me that I terrified her. Like that period of our life, I terrified her. I wanted to figure out why, and I needed to have like a purpose behind what was going on, but I was not doing it with much focus. I wanted to have fun, I wanted to distract myself, and I wanted to find any kind of answer at the same time. And so I left home, I went off to college, and I did just that. I left my safety net behind, and I can tell you I took a pretty long, slow tumble downward. I literally wasn't afraid of anything. I had put together this whole thought process, like, what are the odds that an entire group of men in the same family could be wiped out in a short period of time? So I wasn't afraid of anything because I was like, eh, it can't be that good. So yes, I terrified my mom. The next 4 years were pretty much like this, I'm open to anything if you can give me kind of an answer. And I didn't really care what the source was, but I really didn't listen much to God, because I thought, well, I've pretty much heard most of those answers. It's still there, but I let's see what else there is that can find me an answer. And I don't know if I did that specifically or if it was just like, I don't mind if I'm open to this. And again, I just wanted to have fun and distract myself from the realities of my life. As you can probably piece together, I ran into quite a bit of trouble. I was pretty well stuck into a rut. Jillian warned me. She's like, I don't know if you want to say that, but the fact of the matter is I was almost arrested a bunch. I just used to be fast so I could outrun them. But I remember finally hitting a point where I was, quite frankly, it was legally, I was at a point where I could get in some big trouble, and I called my mom, and she looked at me, and she just said to me, it's time that you deal with it. I never did anything out of ill intent. I literally was just running around trying to distract myself, and I was trying to find purpose. And I believe a counselor, a psychiatrist calls this essentially a distraction technique. And for me at this time, this was a horribly, horribly set idea. But amidst all of that distraction, I had one consistent good thing going for me. I daily read my Bible and did my devotions, just as my parents had unknowingly taught me. I honestly would get home at like 4 a.m. after being out all night at the bar and would not let myself go to sleep without doing my daily devotions. It's just, I don't know, something I did. And I don't say that to highlight how great I am. I literally tell you that because it was the one anchor that told me, don't blame God. You just repeatedly told me, don't blame God. And it was the reminder I had. And it started to whisper a little bit and say, I have a purpose for you. And through some of those poor times, poor decisions, I had a real wake-up call. And so I started to really search. And I did what I had seen a lot of people model for me. And I started to pray a lot, and I started to read a lot. I read the Bible a lot. I read Oswald Chambers. I read C.S. Lewis. I read some really good stuff. And then I read a book called The Ragamuffin Gospel by Brennan Manning. Brennan Manning is a recovering alcoholic who in his book essentially describes that Christ still wants and loves you even if you're a mess. And in reality, that was the best way to describe me since I was about 14 years old. A big mess. And when I had left a wonderful home and my wonderful safety net and got really distracted, more than anything, the mess was evident. But I was still loved, and I was still wanted by Christ, even though I was that huge mess. And that same book also explained that I had a purpose still, even though I was a mess. There was a purpose behind it. And I learned that my purpose was to focus on Christ and essentially live for him and use any gifts he had given me to bless him and also reveal him to anybody else around me. And I learned that I may not find answers to the why behind my life and what happened in my life. And I learned that he was in control, and it was all part of his plan for me. And that was kind of what gave me purpose. Now, I will tell you that I, as I planned this, I literally was trying to figure out the best way to put that, because it's really, if you talk to anybody that goes through a similar circumstance, when someone gives the answer I just gave for why things happen, they will look at you and say, nope, not buying it. And what's really funny is this morning I was doing my devotions, and why try to put it in words when somebody much smarter than me already has. And so this is my morning devotion. It's My Utmost for His Highest by Oswald Chambers. And this is this was today's devotion. It's called Gracious Uncertainty. The verse it opens up with is from 1 John 3:2, and it says, a portion of it, it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. And this is what it says. I'm going to read the whole thing. Our natural inclination is to be so precise, trying always to forecast accurately what will happen next, that we look upon uncertainty as a bad thing. We think that we must reach some predetermined goal, but that is not the nature of the spiritual life. The nature of the spiritual life is that we are certain in our uncertainty. Consequently, we do not put down roots. Our common sense says, well, what if I were in that circumstance? But we cannot presume to see ourselves in any circumstance in which we have never been. Certainty is the mark of the common sense life. Gracious uncertainty is the mark of the spiritual life. To be certain of God means that we are uncertain in all our ways, not knowing what tomorrow may bring. This is generally expressed with a sigh of sadness, but it should be an expression of breathless expectation. We are uncertain of the next step, but we are certain of God. As soon as we abandon ourselves to God and do the task he has placed closest to us, he begins to fill our lives with surprises. When we become simply a promoter or a defender of a particular belief, something within us dies. That is not believing God. It is only believing our belief about him. Jesus said in Matthew 18:3, unless you become as little as children. The spiritual life is the life of a child. We are not uncertain of God, just uncertain of what he is going to do next. If our certainty is only in our beliefs, we develop a sense of self-righteousness, become overly critical, and are limited by the view that our beliefs are complete and settled. But when we have the right relationship with God, life is full of spontaneous, joyful uncertainty and expectancy. Jesus said in John 14:1, believe also in me. He did not say, believe certain things about me. Leave everything to him, and in it will be gloriously and graciously uncertain how he will come in, but you can be certain that he will come. Remain faithful to him. So that says it a lot better than I could. I began searching and praying for purpose. And through some pretty miraculous circumstances, I learned quite a bit about myself. I learned a couple of things. First, I learned that I wanted to use my hands to help others. Looking back, it's kind of a coincidence. My dad and my brother worked with their hands. Construction, car wash, it's what they did. I learned that I was meant to interact with others around me. I was the baby of the family. All I wanted to do was be surrounded by people all day long. And I learned that I was meant to help people. I had been helped by caring people for years at this point, and I wanted to do that. So obviously God chose me to be a dentist. Many of you probably laugh at that, but the reality is I will use my hands all day long. I get to interact with people around me, and it's still kind of funny to me that mostly it's like a male dentist and then all women. If you look at my life, I lost all the men and all I had was my sisters and my mom. Like, I'm just surrounded by literally motherly and sisterly figures all day long that work with me. And I get to help people all day long. People usually come in not feeling good, and I get to help them. I love it. At the same time, I also learned that I could be deeply loved and also deeply love. And I met my wife around that time. And it is kind of funny, she also happened to be a dental hygienist. God has a sense of humor. So currently, I am married into, as I said, an incredible family. Many of you know the Bergsmas. I can tell you too as a highlight. I would say Jillian kind of sealed the deal, and then her family was like, oof, this is really good. But her dad just locked it in. I remember the first time I met him, he reminded me so much of my own dad. It was incredible. And I actually found out after we were married, my uncle, so my dad's brother, who was 2 years older than my dad, he actually wrote a letter to my father-in-law, and he even said how much he reminded him of my dad. But a huge blessing, my in-laws. My sisters and their families are just sweet. I would say that all the junk that was thrown at us, God was the glue that made us closer, and we are very close as a result of it. In fact, this morning, the first two text messages I woke up to were from my two sisters. Both of them said that they were praying for me, and I know that each of them probably knew kind of how difficult this would be for me. Bree even sent me a picture of my brother-in-law in his boxer briefs and said, just remember to look and imagine everyone's naked. And my mom is sturdy as a rock. She is a constant reminder to me that, like, holy smokes, like, God will never give you more than you can't handle. She always reminds me of Job from the Bible. And as I get older and build a family, I understand more and more, like, what she went through and, like, the terrors that I put her through, aside from everything else she had to deal with. And she just amazes me. I have three wonderful children. Nola, who is essentially 4 and a half, and my son Bronson, who will be 3 here in July, and my 8-month-old Brecht. And I'll tell you, it was a huge privilege to be able to name my oldest son after my brother, and his middle name is my dad's middle name. That was one of the coolest experiences of my life. And I have a wonderful wife, Jillian. She puts up with a very broken man. She loves me like crazy and cleans up a lot of my messiness. I am not fixed, and I will never be fixed. I live in a very broken world. I'm a big mess that has a little more direction and some wisdom. I still have very horrible days of sadness, lots of crying, lots of depression, lots of sleeping, lots of anger at people around me, and it's not too dissimilar from those two very bad days I had when I was younger. And it might be cliche, but when I get into those downward spirals, my go-to is to recognize that Christ loves me and he wants me to enjoy him and his creation, and he wants me to live in a way that glorifies him. In the last 2 years, I've had a couple of different teachers that have gone on the concept of Back to the Future. First, one of my favorite movies of all time. Second, as I'm always getting into new territory in life as a father, as a husband, walking with my back to the future and my face towards my past, it reminds me how God carried me through. And it's one of the most encouraging things ever. That alone gives me purpose on my bad days. He built a family around me that has surrounded me then and now that builds me up. And we get through difficult times together. He put a safety net around me that, like I said, still checks on me to this day. And he gave me a brother and a dad that I will forever cherish. And so I've learned a couple of things from keeping my face to the past. First, I am confident that God has actively been working in my life the entire time. There are specific details and events that I could spend days talking to you about that it was like wow, what are what? Wow. And there's no other way to describe that other than that God had his hand active. From literally the way I met Jillian, I, again, didn't grow up over here. I was just visiting my sister and didn't want to come visit her that night, and we ran into Jillian. To the way that I went and job shadowed a dentist for the first time. I was supposed to be leaving for Cedar Point with my mom and my sisters and instead scheduled an impromptu job shadowing of a dentist who had told me I should shadow him. And verbatim, I said, who would ever want to be a dentist? That's weird. And I sat there, and within the first 2 minutes, literally, I had the same feeling I had when I met Jillian. Boom. This is God. To the fact that my aunt Linda came to know Christ through the death of my dad and my brother, and for about 4 years now, she has been with them after struggling with a battle with cancer. God has been totally in control. There's a book that describes those kind of coincidence moments as God winks. First of all, I really like that because my dad was a winker. He just kind of wink. And I've had a lot of those. I've had a lot of God winks. Second thing I learned is, as you might imagine, my perspective on life and death is very unique. And I believe it's a direct result of a simple prayer. God, don't let me blame you. My eternal perspective on life has led me to understand that both my father and my brother were able to finish their race early and end at essentially the ultimate destination where we're all trying to get. That perspective goes, wow, what a joy. I do have earthly sadness in moments where I begin to miss them. And if I sit and think about it, though, the reality is they are doing fine. They're actually doing much better than fine. They're doing better than we could even imagine. And if I had a choice, I would not bring them back here. The third thing I've learned is that God is 100% faithful to me. Every time I chose to turn to him after a lot of those downward spirals, it was as if he was always present, waiting for me, waiting my arrival. And I can look at each one of my family members, my sisters and my mom, and we could have the same conversation that essentially those two events that were huge and big challenges in our life were not the only huge challenging events we've had in our life. In fact, my oldest sister, who just turned 44, is pregnant with her first. That was a long, long, long challenge of not getting pregnant. But the one thing that we learned was that God's presence and his faithfulness were there through both those challenges. And he was consistently present with us and unwavering. So essentially in closing, again, I told you I'd come full circle. That song that I played at the beginning, I Can Only Imagine. I assume most of you obviously have heard that and probably are more aware of it now recently since the movie was made about it. But that song is by a band called Mercy Me. It was originally released in 1999, and if you know anything about the song or the actual writer of the song, the lead singer, Bart, he also lost his father. And as you can kind of put together with timing, that song literally was the theme song for my family, both funerals. We had people sing it, but literally I've sat through more times of that song just sobbing. We even had a family friend that covered the song and made an album and then dedicated it to my brother. And so that song to me is a hard song to hear because it brings a flood of memories. It brings a lot of emotions. And shortly after or within the time period where I felt like God was kind of showing me purpose, Mercy Me released an album called All That Is Within Me in 2007. And I literally, I felt like I was at a place where I could finally go and embrace that song. And so I went and bought the album. It's a compact disc for some of the really young kids. It's a CD. And I bought it and with the idea that I was going to kind of overcome something, like face it, because I knew I had the strength to. And it was the first Mercy Me song or album I had ever bought. And I wanted to have the song that in many ways reminded me of the previous decade in my life. And I will tell you that I put the CD in, I started to listen to it, I went right to the song because that album actually had I Can Only Imagine as a live recording. And I couldn't finish it. And so I did exactly what you're supposed to do and I avoided it. I literally flipped through the album to try to get to a different song. Has a really good technique. And I ran into the song Finally Home, which is really cool because I found out that Rex used this same song last week. I wasn't here, but again, I look at this as like a God wink. But they had on that album a song called Finally Home. And I can tell you with confidence that I heard that song and I thought to myself, that is cool. And since then, it has been kind of my theme song. And though I love I Can Only Imagine and I will cherish that song forever, I've basically taken this song and replaced it as my theme song. And I'd like you all to hear.
Thanks, Brenton. Walker Harbor Church, we're a family around here, so when we wrap up, we're going to grab chairs and stack them. But as a word of benediction and blessing, may you know, both in the good, the bad, and the painful, may you have eyes to see God winking all around you. And as you go, may you know that the grace and peace of Christ goes with you all. Amen.